species. This is the age of biology, and biology should be playing a central role in education and understanding development. And there are a lot of really central ideas from biology that go back all the way to Darwin, many of them. We're going to talk about a lot of those today. Ethology, embryology, evolution, epigenesis, emergence. Sometimes I call this the E-word lecture. Darwin started the modern biology. Virtually all branches of it grow from him. And likewise, he started a lot of work in human development, a lot of work in understanding how we are a species, and how that's our species nature is essential to understanding how we become who we are. So today we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the dynamics of growth and evolution broadly, focusing on the field of ethology, which analyzes species-specific behavior, focusing on our nature as a species of primates, and on characteristics of embryology, of how we develop from a fertilized egg into a full-grown human being. The way all of those fit together in modern biology within a dynamic perspective. So first, we are a species, Homo sapiens sapiens, we call ourselves. This is one of the many demonstrations in human history of our arrogance. Sapiens means wise, so we're not only wise, we're wise, very, very wise. A questionable characteristic in some people's judgment, given the state of self-destruction that we've been showing in the 20th century. But in any case, Darwin argued that to understand our own behavior, to understand the behavior of any species, we have to understand how it relates to being a species. This is a picture of him when he was a young man. He'd already created the theory of evolution, but he was still hiding it because he was afraid of the consequences for him personally and for his family of making it public. This is an illustration of some of the consequences when he did make it public. He was vilified by many people. But along the way, he was starting an incredible set of biological sciences. The field of ethology, which he founded with this assumption that behaviors are species characteristics, has been going strong for over 100 years, and it analyzes species-specific behaviors. Now, species-specific behaviors are activity patterns or characteristics that of our behavior that are typical of a species. It doesn't mean that it only has to be for one species. They can be typical of multiple species. Most primates use their hands for all sorts of complex acts. So that kind of hand use pattern is species specific to many species. Ethology, the word, comes from the Greek word for depicting character or portraying character. So what ethology is the science of depicting the character of a species in terms of its behavior. In ethology, what you're trying to do is kind of like being an anthropologist for a species, trying to take the perspective of the species, of what it's like in its natural habitat without interference. So you go to its natural habitat, you observe it unobtrusively, you don't interfere, and you try to describe that species' activities from its own viewpoint, focusing especially on what it does and how what it does relates to its adaptation to its habitat where it lives. This has been a major approach in biology, and it's had important implications for understanding human development. Here's an example of a species-specific behavior in the wolf. when wolves are fighting or in conflict, also in play, certain kinds of play, they if one of them turns on its back and exposes its neck, that's a sign of submission, and then the other wolf will not attack it. It's a way of keeping wolves from killing each other that's evolved over many millennia. This is an example of human species-specific behavior, an extreme version of it. If you touch the palm of a baby, a newborn baby, they'll and they're awake and alert, they will grasp your finger. If you touch their feet, you can get the aggressive response in the feet, too. And in rare circumstances, when you can get them all to work in just the right way, you can hang a baby from a rope, as in this picture. But don't try it at home. We don't want falling babies. It's just the point is that there is a grasping response that's present at birth that's evoked by a touch to the palm, and that's a species-specific behavior in human beings, similar to what's also present in many primates, where monkeys often, for example, start hanging on their mother's fur shortly after they're born with this grasping response. One of my favorite species-specific behaviors in babies is the greeting response. This is Seth, my oldest, when he was just a few months old. And he's looking in his mom's eyes, cooing and smiling, like, ooh. And that's a response that happens in most babies at around 2, 3, 4 months of age. A very welcome response from caregivers, usually mothers, who are very tired from not getting enough sleep and taking care of this nearly helpless baby. Now the baby's suddenly responding to them. A common response is, oh, he loves me. So it's an important response for helping build that attachment relationship between the mother and the baby. In general, human beings are really fundamentally social. It seems to be one of our most important characteristics. It's behind our intelligence, our language, our culture, and a whole lot of the important social behaviors are grounded in species-specific origins, like the greeting response. One of the most important species-specific characteristics in us and in many other primates is eye-to-eye contact. When you look into somebody else's eyes, that is a major marker. Babies seek out other people's eyes when they're doing face-to-face contact by the time they're a couple of months of age. It has at least two kind of major emotional meanings. Sometimes it's a threat, you know, like... And sometimes it's a kind of an affectionate behavior. So when two people are really good friends or when they're in love with each other, they frequently look in each other's eyes, as in this couple on the screen. So there are a whole lot of species-specific behaviors, a whole lot of behaviors that are characteristic of the human species or of whichever species we're looking at, and they generally fall into broad categories of... behaviors around sensory systems, like we have a visual system based on light, and that's crucial for us, and there are a whole lot of our behaviors that are organized around that, in contrast to, say, many bats, which have a whole lot of their seeing based on echolocation, on bouncing sound off things, so they have a different kind of a perceptual system. Action systems like the hand for human beings. Horses don't have hands, so they don't have that action system, and species-specific learning systems. We'll talk especially about learning systems today, because for understanding educational issues and human development issues more broadly, learning is really essential, and there are species-specific learning systems, just like other kinds of behavioral systems. Now, in all of this, when people start talking about a species characteristic, there's a tendency for us to start right away thinking about genes, genetics, like it's hereditary. Of course, genes play a role in species-specific behaviors, but there's a whole lot of other stuff that's important, including really major environmental influences. This cartoon illustrates how we get carried away with genes often. What sense does it make to say my genes made me do it when a thug has just beat up a baby? Well, maybe there's some genetic contribution to that, but there's a whole lot of other stuff going on. And for most of what we want to do as developmentalists and educators and even as biologists is to have a more sophisticated analysis than that. In fact, in the area of genes, one of the really important innovations that's needed, that people are just moving towards, is to figure out how the genes work together. In biology right now, one of the most important and hot topics is understanding developmental processes and how genes and chemicals and environment all work together to produce, for example, the development of cells into more complicated cells or into more specialized cells to form things like brains and hands and eyes. We know a lot about individual genes. We don't know very much about how genes work together. So we really need more systems analysis in that area. Maybe some of us or some of you will discover some of the innovations that we need in order to develop this genetic systems analysis. There have been some great discoveries in ethology that give us a sense of where we need to go, maybe, in understanding learning and how it has a species-specific characteristic. In fact, some ethologists coined the phrase instincts learn. For some of us, that almost seems like a contradiction, but it makes the point that the kind of learning that we're good at is a species-specific characteristic. And one of the most dramatic illustrations of this is the study of learning in the honeybee by Carl von Frisch. Bees learn where pollen is found, and they communicate that location to other members of their hive by a dance they do in the hive. And the bees that are watching the dance use that information to go out and find where the pollen is for building honey, for making things in the hive. They can't learn a whole lot of other things, but they're very good at learning those specific things about how to find flowers or sources of sugar. A bowl of sugar will also attract them, sugar water. There's several examples of this kind of species-specific learning that ethologists have discovered and studied. Probably the most famous in human development is imprinting. Imprinting is a species-specific attachment, a process of learning that's delimited to a particular period in which birds or other animals learn who their mother is, in most cases, who their caregiver is. And from that, they then generalize to what their species is. So this led to the idea of a critical period. A period in which in just a day or a few hours, you learn who your mom is. When you're a newborn duckling, you come out of your egg, see this big duck walking around, you start following her. That following leads you to become imprinted on her as your mother. And there's a narrow time period in which that works very effectively. For some reason the duck can't follow its mother during that time period, then it's much harder for it to learn who its mother is. Now, in people, it gets much more complicated than that, but we're going to talk a little bit about the ducks and the chicks and the geese first, because there it's a very nice example of a species-specific learning characteristic. But in people have sometimes wanted to rapidly and easily apply this to human beings, and in fact, human beings don't show a narrow critical period for attachment the way ducks do. As John Brewer says, if infants really needed highly specific experiences to become normal adults, the human race would be extinct. So how about ducks? Well, Konrad Lorenz is the person best known for work on imprinting. He was an Austrian ethologist. actually not only discovered and explored imprinting at great length, but helped broadly to establish the field of ethology. And he and von Frisch and Tinbergen won the Nobel Prize for that work in ethology in 1973. So what he did was establish that there's a following response in baby birds that leads to this attachment through this learning process called imprinting. And as his own work and other people's work followed, it became clear that you needed a dynamic analysis to explain that. We're going to focus a little bit today on introducing what it means to do a dynamic analysis about biological development. Now, dynamics has not been broadly accepted in the field until recently. Now it's become one of the very popular new approaches. When I was in graduate school, it was considered alien. I was told that if you got a complicated growth curve like what you usually see in dynamics, that that was considered bad data. You didn't collect it right. So I called that alien dynamics. But these days, it's really changed. In fact, dynamic systems is pervasive in the biological and physical sciences and in neuroscience. And we in child development are a bit behind with these other fields that have been using dynamics for 20 or 30 years to try to explain things like development and learning and species change. So what we have now is something that I like to call constructive dynamics, in which we're looking at nonlinear growth patterns such as imprinting, such as epigenesis, which we'll talk about a little later, and understanding how multiple processes come together to produce this growth pattern. So for imprinting, an American ethologist named Eckhard Hess has one of the nicest demonstrations of a kind of dynamic explanation, one that's relatively easy to understand. He did this before dynamics became a popular approach. But basically, he showed that the critical period in birds for imprinting comes from an interaction of walking, development of walking, with the development of fear. So if we are looking at hours since hatching, that's the first day and a half after the chick hatches, on the y-axis we have the percent of chicks that are able to walk and the percent that are showing fear to a novel object. Here's the walking. You see in the first day there's a big increase in the number of chicks who can walk. By the end of the first day, all of them can walk. But at the same time, there's a change in their fear. So initially, they don't show much fear at all. But over time, the fear to novelty increases. So you see the red line shows that. By the end of the first day, about half of the chicks are showing fear of novel objects. And by a day and a half, all of them are. When you put those two things together, it turns out that they perfectly explain the critical period for imprinting. It's the combination of the ability to walk. You need to walk in order to be able to follow your mom, and the fear of novel or strange objects that produces the critical period for imprinting. A whole lot of developmental processes involve this kind of dynamic interaction of several things to produce a particular phenomenon. And that's something we're going to talk about more, and that's something that we really need, I think, as a goal for the field, to be able to come up with explanations that really put the components together so we can understand the rich complexity of human development. So, attachment in people. It's a species-specific learning characteristic. It doesn't show imprinting. It doesn't happen in a day or a month or even a couple of years. It's a much longer-term process. People have sometimes talked about it as if it involves imprinting. It does not. But it does involve a kind of a developmental sensitivity. So early in development, in the first couple of years, it looks like kids can establish close relationships more easily. As they become more wary about strangers and things, it becomes harder over time. It's a benefit to the child if they develop a loving, close relationship early in their lives. there's been a lot of studies of human attachment. and we'll come back to them later in the semester. People commonly talk about secure attachment, avoidant attachment, anxious attachment as growing out of the nature of the early relationships that the baby has with its mother and other caregivers. species. We're talking about species, right? We're talking about the human species, mostly. Which species shows these characteristics? Babies suck their thumbs. Vision is really important. Young organisms like to play. There are a lot of emotions. There's strong signs of intelligence, including using tools. There's aggressiveness under some circumstances. There's a dominance hierarchy where there are dominant and adults and middle dominance adults and low dominance adults. There's an attachment system between offspring and mother or other adults. There's a lot of communication using the face and voice. There are really large brains, and there's a long life. That sounds kind of like people, but actually we're describing something else, chimpanzees. chimpanzees are very close relatives of ours, and they have many characteristics that are a lot like ours. They even have simple cultures based on things like tool use. Some groups of chimpanzees teach their offspring to catch termites with sticks, and other groups of chimps don't. There are a whole lot of other pieces of the chimpanzee culture that are transmitted in that way. This is the sound of a chimpanzee call. That's a little different from human speech, though babies actually sound kind of like that sometimes when they're crying. So we are primates, like chimpanzees, like gorillas, like rhesus monkeys, and those characteristics are really essential for understanding what we're like as human beings and how we develop. So broad characteristics of human species that are very important for anyone who wants to study cognitive development, emotional development, education. All three of these characteristics are tied to our exceptional brain, this very large thing we have here in the head that we'll talk more about in a bit, and they're tied to the social nature that we talked about before, that we're very much into other people and need other people to become what we're capable of. So the three characteristics that are really important are the intelligence and emotionality. They go together. In our culture, they're often treated as opposites, but they really are two sides of the same coin. Language and culture. And we'll elaborate on all three of those as we proceed in our course. What about this big brain that makes all these things possible? If you base the size that our brain should be, you estimate what it should be based on other primates or other mammals, it should be about a pound. But it's actually three times that. It's about 3 pounds. So we have this huge brain. Has a lot of implications. It's also folded in, as you can see here, to fit in all these many, many neurons that we have. And this is another way of illustrating the odd size, the very, very large size. This is a graph that graphs body weight for species against brain weight. And in general, you can draw a line for mammals that, where you can predict the brain weight of a species from its body weight. So elephants would have much larger brains than mice. But apes in general are a bit above the line. Here you see the gorilla and the chimpanzee. Human beings are way above the line. An early human species, Australopithecus and Homo sapiens. We have about 20 billion neurons estimate in our mostly in our brains, and that's I'm sorry, this is just the cortex. 20 billion neurons in the cortex. Even more if you count the rest of the brain and the spinal cord and other nerves. Very, very large nervous system. We're also quite helpless when we're born. Most primates, when they're born, like chicks, can walk within a day, can cling to their mother. I raised a baby rhesus myself, and at a couple of days, she could walk across the table, stumbling some, falling some. She could reach over and pick up, you know, a little ball or an ashtray or a pencil. It was, you know, awkward. Not terribly skilled, but she could do it. Human babies can't do anything like that at birth. It takes months for them to develop those skills. A question is, why are we born so early? Why don't we stay inside mom longer so that we, the babies can be born able to begin to crawl and grasp things, being more competent? It's a big burden for mom that they're born, and for everybody in the family, but especially for mom in most cases when the baby is born so helpless. You even have to carry them all the time. They can't even grab onto your hair and just hang on. This is a big question, the general answer we're going to elaborate here, but broadly it's that babies need to be born early in order to be able to be born, because their heads are so big. In general, there's an extension of the whole process of development in human beings. Not only do we have a head that's three times as big as it should be, but we also have heartbeats that are different from what's predicted by body size. Our heart rate is slower. Our breaths are slower. Our cell divisions are slower. Our metabolism is slower. Generally, you can predict all kinds of things from body size. All of these things from body size. You do that line I showed you for brain size. You can do the same thing for heart rate. You can do the same thing for cell divisions. If you take an animal's body size, you can predict these things from it quite accurately. But human beings are off the curve in all these things because we live so long. We live like three times as long as we're supposed to for our body size. Development is epigenesis. Okay, we're going to now go through the process of development, how a human being is formed in a kind of broad stroke, and part of it we'll be seeing some of the implications of this very large brain for the early birth. The process of development is generally called epigenesis. That comes from embryology, where when people first tried to understand how human beings developed in the uterus, they were quite puzzled. Eventually, over many decades, they came up with this idea of epigenesis, which is that there's a big qualitative change from the fertilized egg into the human being. They're not the same thing just getting bigger, but there is an enormous qualitative change. So epigenesis literally means development, genesis in the sense of development, not genes, after or succeeding. So you have one form succeeding another form in epigenesis. Understanding this, of course, requires an analysis of the dynamic processes of change developing from this fertilized egg. Here's just an illustration of it. The discovery of this major transformation, we go from a fertilized egg to a crawling baby. They don't look anything like each other. that's what epigenesis is trying to describe, that process of qualitative change. So we started off with an egg and a sperm. At the beginning of trying to understand what was going on, people saw that there were eggs and saw that there were sperms, but they believed that one of them was a little person that just got bigger. The conundrum was, how do you get a person from a little egg or a little sperm? And people at first believed in preformation. So when they saw the sperm, they thought it was a little person. Actually, you know, if you imagine from this tiny little sperm, it's kind of got thin things at the bottom that might be legs and a big thing at the top that might be a head. Some even thought that the ovum was a little person. And then they discovered that that didn't work at all. Instead there was a process of epigenesis, a fundamental transformation in shape that began with fertilization of the egg by the sperm. So here we have the egg and the sperm come together. A bunch of sperm try to fertilize the egg in the normal process. Only one of them gets in. Then the egg shuts itself down, doesn't let any more in. You have a fertilized ovum. And then there's initially a major quantitative increase. So the egg reproduces itself, and you end up with 2 cells, and then 4 cells, and then 16 cells. I'm sorry, 8 cells, and then 32 cells, and so forth. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You get a giant ball of cells that are all pretty much the same. But there's eventually a transformation in quality where that ball of cells becomes differentiated into 3 different layers, which are attached to the wall of the uterus. Those layers are eventually, as they separate out, ectoderm, endoderm, and mesoderm, which are the 3 layers that form the parts of the body, all of our organs and so forth. So the first obvious qualitative change is that instead of just a big ball of cells, it becomes a kind of differentiated ball with different layers. Then eventually that differentiated ball turns into a person, as illustrated with the transformation in the first 3 months here, gradual transformation from a ball into a fetus at 3 months. The fetus looks very human. And then finally, the fetus gets transformed into a human newborn. That last picture there gives a bit of an idea about how hard it is to get the baby through the birth canal with that big head. The baby's head is very flexible. The skull is actually not closed so that it can be squished. My head's rather large, you might notice. When I was born, my head was squished, kind of pointy on top. And a lot of babies are born with funny-shaped heads like that. My son, actually, Seth, got stuck when he was being born, there had to be a quick emergency C-section because his head was stuck in the opening and wouldn't come through. How do we think about this process of epigenesis? Well, a useful metaphor for framing it is the developmental web. When you think about the developing baby, there isn't just one ladder of development, you know. There are all sorts of things, qualitative changes and things separating out from each other. Epigenesis implies a web. And if we use the web metaphor, which we'll use frequently in the class, you start out with a fertilized egg. It gets differentiated into endoderm, mesoderm, and ectoderm. The endoderm becomes digestive tissue and respiratory tissue. The mesoderm becomes muscle and bone. The ectoderm becomes skin and nervous tissue. Eventually, you end up with eyes and skin and a heart and a stomach and all sorts of and a brain, all sorts of different organs. So you need many branches to be able to capture the big picture of how we go from a single fertilized egg into a full-grown human baby. The A key characteristic of this epigenetic process is not only that it forms a web, but also that new structures emerge that we're having. We start with cells, and we end up with hearts and brains and so forth, very different kinds of things. This emergence is a really important characteristic of development. And that emergence is shaped by both environment and genes working together. So what about emergence? Well, emergence turns out to be characteristic of the physical world all over the place, right? We go from atoms to molecules. We go from cells to organs. We go from you know, little things to bigger things at all kinds of levels in physics and biology and weather systems, everything that you can think about in the physical and biological world has little pieces that combine to form bigger pieces, and the bigger pieces are very different from the little pieces. That's emergence. A nice metaphor for it is points to lines to planes to solids, which I'll elaborate a little bit in a minute. There's also a new kind of computer-based knowledge that's grown up about how a few simple local rules for change can produce developmental process that looks very complicated, that has emergent properties. So this is a way of beginning to explain some of the change. It turns out with some small local rules, you can have remarkable changes producing emergent properties, emergent entities. This has been described with great verve and energy in a new book by Wolfram called A New Kind of Science. It's been around for maybe 30 years now as a field. So emergence involves things combining to form something new and different. Here we have some lines. Those lines combine and they form a new thing, a square, which is made up of the lines, but it's quite different from the lines. That's a kind of geometric example of emergence. In terms of the simple mathematical models with the local rules, the kind of things that can produce some instances of emergence, I'm going to give you an illustration of that with the game of Life 32. Wolfram was one of the inventors of this game, and it involves a few simple local rules for changing the pixels on a screen, and they lead to what looks like growing living things. Let me show you. I'm going to draw a line, a few different things, and then I'm going to just start it. You see how it's changing, and things start walking across the screen. Things move over to something else and kind of eat it up. And this, there's no executive, there's no king telling the pixels what to do. They're just local rules as to how they change based on what the pattern is of pixels in a particular local area. You're invited to try this out and play with it yourself to get a little bit of a sense of how these models work. They're an important kind of model for explaining development. So it's actually useful to play with this game a little bit. It's called Life 32. It's available on the website for the course. And also it's generally shareware, so you can use it on your own computer if you'd like. Okay, so qualitative change characterizes development in general. These kinds of agent-based models that I just illustrated are one example of how that of the processes behind that. In broadly for human behavior and human body, brain action and thought is what we're focusing on. We have this epigenetic process of growth, and you can see it in the shapes of the growth curves, as well as in the patterns of organs and behaviors. This is interesting because it we have a myth in the field that growth occurs in a linear, simple way, but in fact it doesn't. So this is the kind of standard model of growth, as you see in a pediatrician's growth chart, a very simple version of it, where which is, I think, a modern form of preformism. It's like the baby starts very small and gets very big, and there really aren't qualitative changes. But even after birth, there are important qualitative changes going on, all kinds of them. They're really evident when you look at cognitive capacities, but also at other things like the size of the head relative to the body and the presence of secondary sexual characteristics and a bunch of other obvious things like that. Here's an example of the standard smoothed growth curve. There's an acknowledgement in pediatrics that girls and boys have different growth curves, but it's treated as if that curve captures the actual growth of individual boys and girls. And it doesn't at all. For real kids, you see very much more interesting growth patterns than that. Here's an example from my son, Seth. Before we had other kids, I had the time to measure his head regularly. It's hard to do when you have a bunch of other kids around, so I didn't do it as well for the later kids. But for Seth, you see the growth curve of his head circumference. Measure just the circumference around the head. And you see it's not a linear curve at all. It in fact has peaks and drops. And they're fairly systematic. And they relate to a bunch of things, including the broad process of growth of the brain and other things like the baby's health. So, for example, when Seth had a very his first very bad cold in the first couple of months, his head stopped growing, you know, for a week or so until he got over his cold. The point here is that that it's a dynamic growth process, even for something like head circumference. If you replot them as change scores, then you get to see dramatically how there are ups and downs. It's not a linear growth at all. In fact, there are four times when there's very statistically reliable growth spurts, and then like drops following them. So this kind of epigenetic development of the brain, this was head circumference for Seth. It wasn't literally the brain. There's a correlation, a little bit loose one, but there is a correlation. But that fits and start pattern occurs for brain tissue, brain activity, you know, lots of different psychological and cognitive emotional characteristics. These complex growth curves are an enormous help for us who are trying to understand development, because if you just have smooth curves for everything, then you can try to figure out how one thing relates to another. But if you have these complicated curves, you can look at a curve for head growth or a curve for brain growth and relate that to a curve for cognitive growth, see whether the complex bumps and drops relate to each other. Here's an example for cell density. Most people don't think about this, but when you look at cell density in the frontal region, according to an old, classic old study by Blinkoff and Glazer in Russia, cell density in this frontal region actually rises and drops systematically, showing fits and starts. There's growing evidence that the brain tissue actually shrinks periodically. So you in some of the early work with head circumference, when people found evidence that the head got a little bit smaller, they didn't believe it. They thought it was measurement error. And now it looks like that actually happens sometimes, that we have not just growth, but we have kind of growth and a little bit of contraction, and then growth and a little bit of contraction. Now, here's some of the nicest data on this relevant to cognitive development involve brain activity measured by the electrical activity in the brain, EEG. Here we're going to look at relative power in the EEG. That means the amount of energy in one piece of the wave in the EEG divided by the total energy in the whole wave. We'll elaborate on this at another point in the course, and there's lots of good stuff to read about it if you're interested in it now. But I'm going to give you just one example from infancy that shows this fits and starts pattern. This is a study done in Japan in the 70, and you see the red line is the average power relative power in the EEG in these babies, in the occipital area in the back of the brain, and the blue lines show the range. So you see there are fits and starts, and there are three periods of kind of peaks in this that are like the drops and jumps that we saw for head circumference and for a frontal neural tissue. Now, experience shapes this development too. When we start talking about these growth patterns, it's easy to fall into the assumption that it's genetic. Well, the genes play a major role, but we always have to keep reminding ourselves that genes are working with the environment, and the two are working together. And on brain development, there's wonderful evidence about the plasticity of brain development, that is, its response to specific environmental circumstances, environmental stimulation. One of the books that you're encouraged to look at in the class is written by Marion Diamond and Janet Hobson. Marion is one of the premier researchers in this area, showing how environmental enrichment affects brain development. In her research at Berkeley, she showed that that in young rats, if you take them from a standard lab environment, which is very impoverished, very unstimulating, you know, alone in a cage with not much to do, and you put them in a rich environment with lots of other rats and lots of interesting toys to chew on or climb on or play with, you get a 17% increase in the thickness of the cortex. It's phenomenal. Even in very old rats like equivalent to a 75-year-old person, you still get a 10% increase in cortical thickness when you do that. So the cortex is very responsive to the local environment. When you take those rats that live in the rich environment and you put them in the impoverished environment, the cortex shrinks back down again. In a matter of weeks, you see clear effects from moving from into the rich environment or into the impoverished environment. And when you look more locally at specific brain tissue, as Greeno, Mars, and others have done, you see very dramatic changes and really quickly as a function of experience. So the synaptic dendrites, I'll show you some of them on a diagram of a neuron in a minute, change in 6 minutes from electrical stimulation of the cortex. And by putting in an enriched environment, they've measured a change in 4 days. In the hippocampus, one particular part of the brain, the changes are even faster. Just in a matter of seconds and minutes, you see changes as a function of certain kinds of stimulation. Another example is that in the formation of myelin in the visual cortex, that's the insulation around the axon in the neuron, that's stimulated by visual experience in the human newborn. So here's a neuron. Over on the left, you have dendrites extending from the cell body. They connect to axonal nodes from other neural cells. And when there's a stimulation, like moving into an enriched environment, they grow very energetically. You can get them growing so that they have three additional layers of the kind of division from being in a stimulating environment. The myelin forms on the axon, as shown in the diagram, and it's like a fatty substance that insulates the axon, kind of like insulating electrical wire, so that you get faster transmission of the neural impulse on the axon. So you get also more efficient transmission with less noise, less loss. So the myelin is very important for having good, fast, efficient neural connections. And that is also subject to environmental stimulations like dendrites. There's not been as much work on this, but we did a little study with the Yakovlev collection of brains of babies that had died young. And from that, you could look at the visual experience the effects of visual experience back here in the primary visual cortex. So when babies are born, all of a sudden they have visual experience that they didn't have before. There's no light in utero, so there's little or no visual experience. When they're born in the world, you might notice if you've been at a birth, they are kind of overwhelmed by the light. They react with their eyes, and if it's a very bright light, they often shut their eyes. This is their first visual experience, and it turns out that those early visual experiences right after birth have a powerful effect on the formation of myelin in the visual cortex in the back of the brain. So you can tell by looking at a baby that was babies that were of the same gestational age, the same age since conception, but some have had visual experience and some haven't. And when there's no visual experience, there's no myelin in the visual cortex, or very little. And when there's a lot of visual experience for a month and a half, there's a lot of myelin forming in the visual cortex. So you'll hear more about other ways that this plasticity occurs. The brain is remarkably plastic, remarkably responsive to all kinds of environmental stimulation. And these are just two examples, the growth of dendrites, the growth of myelin in babies. Okay, overall then, what I've tried to show is that we are a species with certain kinds of behavioral characteristics that are typical for our species, and with an embryological pattern, a pattern of development from fertilized egg into human being, that's typical for our species, that those can be illuminated through understanding of classic biological processes, like how do species-specific behaviors occur, what is their nature, how are they learned in processes like imprinting or attachment, how do they relate to our being primates. Our characteristics are very, we think about ourselves as so unique, but in fact most of our characteristics are so very much typical of intelligent primates. And more generally then, how does epigenesis play out as an explanation for human development? Epigenesis being the process of qualitative transformation as you move from a fertilized egg into a complicated person. And psychologically, epigenesis involves how our mind transforms, how the quality of our thinking, the quality of our feelings, the complexity of our activities change as we develop. To put all this together, to get beyond preformism and really explain how development occurs, how human species-specific behaviors develop, emerge, and become more complicated, we need to put them together with a dynamic perspective that looks at individual growth, not just growth curves averaged over many people, and that tries to explain the emergence of important new behaviors, important new capacities in human infants, children, and on into adults.